Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Glad to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about transit benefits. It's a subject near and dear to some people's hearts, and it's one that I don't really understand because I don't get a transit benefit myself. But Meredith Summers is here. Meredith, you wrote the story, and it was called Transition Benefits Lost in Translation. What's that mean?
So transit benefits, like you're saying, not everyone is lucky enough to have these. You and I just drive to work and that's it. But for the federal government, especially around Washington, D.C., where traffic is a disaster, the hope is to encourage public transportation and commuter rail, that kind of thing, buses, trains, carpools, that kind of thing. So this past year, members of Congress passed their omnibus spending bill, which included a bump of federal benefits from $250 per month to $255. So that means if you ride the metro here in D.C. And you spend $270, you get, you know, $255 of that is covered. So it's basically the government helping to pay your trip to and from work.
Well, I know it's my daughter-in-law worked for a very progressive green company, if you will, some years back, and they not only got a transit subsidy, one of the few people I've ever known that did it, but they also got if they biked, they got something, and if they walked, the company bought them shoes once a year.
They bought them shoes?
I swear it, yeah. I mean, it's just...
That's great.
Yeah, but I don't remember now what they did for the bikers, but it was something...
Maybe a helmet.
Yeah, maybe that's it, yeah. Well, no, the amounts are interesting here. They say it went from 200 to 255.
Yeah, so...
That's a big jump.
It is, but you look back... So the problem is that... In theory, this is a great idea. Like, sure, use metro, use a commuter rail line, use a bus, and we'll help pay your cost of using that form of transportation. But this is also Congress and the government. So there's always like catching up on being able to pay for things. And so there's not only the benefits for this year, but Congress said, okay, well, we'll also apply to last year retroactively because you weren't getting the money then, which was at the lower amount. And then before that, it was even lower. And so people are all up in arms because they're like, okay, great, but when is this money coming? And some agencies have said, it might come, it might not. So every agency is different. We did this survey. We asked our readers, hey, what have you been hearing from your agencies? And every agency is different. And some are like, well, they haven't even mentioned retroactive benefits. And some haven't even told us about this year's. So it's all kind of like everybody's sort of a hurry up and wait and see kind of situation. Some said they're fine and things are working, but a lot of people said we don't know when it's coming down the pipe.
Well, you said the magic word retroactive. Yes. I got an email from Bob at GSA and he read your story. In fact, he sent your story to me, but he said, so GSA has provided the increase in transit benefits, but has been absolutely silent on providing retroactive pay back to January 1, 2015. I thought I was misreading that they would make something retroactive. I've never heard of the
And I had talked to Ben Cardin's office. He's one of the senators in Maryland.
Yeah.
And you know, Maryland has a ton of federal commuters. And one of his staffers said the retroactive pay, it might take a while to kick in because it's retroactive. Whether or not we'll see that, you know, who knows? It might come down the line, but you might be paying retroactive. So at that point, I don't know if it like... You know, rebalances itself.
It looks like it's something that animal devouring its own tail, you know.
Yeah, like that snake.
Yeah.
Well, I was looking through some of the comments that people shared with us, and one respondent said, the wording of the change retroactive seems misleading, and to me it implies that we would be credited with the difference above the previous maximum from all of 2015, but I've seen no retroactive benefits. Oh. Yeah, nobody really knows.
This is a town, the devil is in the details.
Yes.
Always the case. Well, you know, I saw something maybe on our sister station, WTOP, the other day that, you know, we have been the number one city as far as rotten traffic for several years now. Mm-hmm. But suddenly we're number five.
Behind
Los Angeles, behind Chicago for sure.
I believe it.
I can't remember the others, but I was a little bit hurt almost. But
right.
The double irony of this is the confusion with the transit benefits, the retroactivity, and the fact that Metro, our subway system here in Washington, has been having so many problems. They've had fatalities.
Yeah.
There have been smoke incidents. There have been lots of stalled trains. There have been some near tragedies that were averted by quick thinking.
One of our colleagues this morning said she experienced her first Metro fire at Union Station because it might have been a plastic bottle on the railway. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, it's a prime target for mm-hmm. terrorists, obviously, for a variety of reasons.
Well, and there have been some people who have written to us saying, well, so for the smart chip cards for people who aren't in the area, it's, you know, it's just a hard plastic kind of credit card. So rather than, well, they've done away with the paper fare cards. So you can reload it sort of like a debit card. And the idea was people who were applying for their transit benefits thought they would just get one lump sum on the card and that was it. But some are saying, well, our agency said, because we don't have the money yet, you're just going to get the first, you know, 130. And then when you're done with that, we'll give you the other, you know, 135, whatever the math is, to equal out to 255. So there are some people who are saying, not only are we not hearing what we need to hear from our agency, we also are being confused by Metro. So it's kind of a snarl of things. And you mentioned that DC has fallen down and being the worst in traffic. And one gentleman who works for the Department of Housing and Urban Development, but he lives out in Sacramento. He has a 181-mile round-trip commute every day.
I believe it.
And he says he drives from Sacramento to Fairfield, California, then takes a BART bus, which is sort of like a commuter bus, to Contra Costa County, and then another train to San Francisco. And he said it's just like insane the amount of time that he spends in his car and his train and whatnot. And so this kind of a benefit would really help him because it's really expensive for him. But he doesn't know when that's going to, you know, kick in.
It's interesting here in the Washington area, which has 14%, I believe, of the total federal population. But there are a lot of feds who commute from West Virginia, Harper's Ferry and beyond. They come in by that.
Or Pennsylvania. They don't think twice about it.
Right. And from the eastern shore of Maryland, mm-hmm. there are people in Dover, Delaware, who work at the Pentagon.
And I spend hours in the car or on a bus. And yeah, $255.
Well, a couple of things. One, and I know you're new to this. But when this started out, a lot of people were worried about fraud. For example, I asked for a subsidy. However they give it to me. Whether it's a card or, mm-hmm. or cash or a voucher, and then I give it to you or sell it to you. Have you seen any evidence of that?
I have not, and nobody's said anything, at least in the people who took our survey. No, I haven't raised the issue, no. They're just more concerned about where the heck do I even go to apply? You know, they can't even get the application that you could then commit fraud on because they aren't hearing either anything from their agencies or they're not getting or they're hearing just enough to get started. Oh, it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, the whole concept most people in the private sector don't know what a transit subsidy is, I assume.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they just go to the drive to work and that's it. And you call or you take Metro and that's it. But because there's so many federal commuters on the roads and if we could do anything to keep lowering that number in traffic, Congress will do it. And so they're like, hey, here's some money to please use mass transit. But it might take a while to eventually get there.
You know, that you can reverse that argument, too, because whenever there's a snow day and they say, tell government workers to stay home, but the rest of us are expected to come to work. Yeah. And I have heard, and I'm sure you have, from some of the rest of us who say, let them go to work and let us stay
home. Let us stay home, yeah.
We'll be willing to make that sacrifice.
Nope.
You're talking about your survey. Is it ongoing?
We just finished it, actually. It is. It's interesting when you look at the results because it sounds like a lot, about 63% of people, so two-thirds or so, have said, yes, we found out something about the transit benefits, that they're going to be happening. They're already here. Some people, though, have said, I had no idea what a transit benefit was.
Hold that thought. We need to take a short break here and be right back on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Meredith Summers. She is relatively new to Federal News Radio, and for her sins, she was assigned to find out about this transit benefits thing that the federal government offers. And it is, you'd think it would be simple. Here's money, take the bus.
But
nothing. It's government. It's too complex.
Yeah.
So yeah, we have the issue of retroactivity. It's mm-hmm. that's mentioned, but there's no, I guess, end date. It could be
TBD. Yeah.
Right. And the difference would be.
Yeah. It comes out to about like $1,400.
Yeah.
If at the top amount, which is like, that's a lot of money for some of us, especially for some of like the single or lower end federal employees, like that's a month of rent in some cases.
Yeah.
Like I would like to have that kind of money.
Well, before we took the break, I rudely interrupted you, but you were talking about some of these results from the survey.
Yeah, we had about 400 people respond, and from all across the government. We had Navy, we had DOD, we had VA, state, CDC, Library of Congress, IRS. And about 2/3 of our respondents said, yes, their agency told them something about the transit benefits. And about 3/4 of them said they were aware of the transit benefits. And there was about 25% who said we had no idea that existed. And so of those respondents who said that their agency had told them about the benefits, most found out in the last 3 months or so. I mean, the transit benefits were supposed to kick in January and the retroactive ones for last year. But there were still a group that only found out in the past few weeks. And so most people were told, okay, there's a $255 cap, and about half of them learned when the benefits were going to take effect. But again, it was just interesting how each agency, some sent emails, some had like meetings, some sent out multiple notifications. There is no like blanket way of explaining to federal employees, this is how the federal transit benefits work. There's the DOT and they have their site with FAQs, but you know, each agency is, you know, it's different. And I would imagine there's probably some agencies that have more commuters than others. But yeah, there was no constant.
And it, you know, in any program like this too, it takes one person or several persons who really care about it, or maybe even hate it, but they get the word out or make sure the word doesn't get out.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what you get, some people who are, like for the IRS, for example, one woman said, oh, I had no idea about this. And she was like super upset. But then there were a couple other people who said, oh, yeah, I'm with the IRS. And they had a wonderful ticketing system. And so you have to wonder, OK, well, who's going to raise a stink about it if there's some people who said this is great? I mean, I for one, can never handle any sort of email notification. And, you know, but that doesn't mean I don't deserve my benefits or something. But they also might not know to ask about it if they haven't even been informed there's this option.
Yeah. Well, you know, talking about ignorance of this thing, I've noticed it's government-wide. There are some places where people, maybe they have a better HR system, maybe they're more plugged in, but the National Institutes of Transition Planning, Bob Lyons group, you know, they have a show here on Monday for your benefit, and they go around to federal agencies by contract and teach them about the benefits, retirement, you know, what have you. And he said invariably at these sessions, which are aimed at longtime employees, you have to be within 5 years of retirement in most cases to come to one of these. So, you know, you've been around a while, you've got some age. He said invariably at every one of these meetings, somebody, a man, a woman, will say, retirement benefits, what retirement benefits?
Oh, gosh.
They literally didn't
know
about the civil service retirement system or FERS. And you think, well, he said there, it always comes as a happy surprise to them, but they simply don't know it. So if something like transit benefit, well, you know, we're saying in the earlier part of the show, 14% of the federal workforce is here, and that's a lot of people, but California has more. But they're also one in every five Americans, I think, is a Californian now, or something ridiculous. But in the metro Washington area, which is Northern Virginia, parts of Maryland, parts of the Eastern Shore now, and even into Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, that's the Washington metro area.
Yeah.
Huge concentration of federal workers. Metro is wonderful, we thought. It's just turned 40, by the way. But Metro is wonderful. But now we're finding out that it catches fire all the time.
It catches fire and trains are late. I mean, this weekend I had to sit on a train that wasn't moving for like 20 minutes. And that's on a weekend. So you imagine during the weekday when like every other person riding with you is a Fed, it really starts to, you think, my God, you can't pay me enough money to ride one of these things.
What I learned the hard way is when I go to a Nationals ball game, and I love it. Our great park, you should visit. If you haven't been there, go there. But when I go to the game, I like to leave early, even if we're winning.
Oh, yeah.
So leave at the seventh inning, go hop on the metro, and then it sits there literally until the train fills up. And I don't understand how that works. But is there any correlation between giving people subsidies to ride public transportation, but we're mostly talking about metro here, although I guess it applies to trains and buses too. But is there any way of telling if this is increased ridership? Because I know metro's lost it recently because of the delays.
That's the thing. If only it was that easy, but because there's so many other mitigating factors like, oh, well, my commuter train caught fire or the delays are so bad. Some people are saying the only thing that I've gather from the surveys along those lines are that people are saying, I'm just going to drive. They would rather just take their own car, and even they're willing to pay, you know, whatever the crazy amount of money is to park in DC over Metro, just because it's getting so expensive on Metro. Their fares, I think they're holding them right now, but just the fact that they have to deal with waiting for a train to fill up or having a single track or something because of the problems, they're just moving over regardless of the subsidy.
Well, one of my sons lives in Maryland and works in Virginia, naturally, the pattern here. And he was dutifully taking Metro, and he said it was taking him an hour to an hour and a half, and it's not that far.
What was his, what stops did he go to?
He would get on near Kensington in Maryland, and he was going to Alexandria. So there's two stops in Alexandria, and I don't know which one, but I've taken them.
Yeah.
And, of course, I've taken them on weekends, and it's fine.
Yeah.
But he said it took him over an hour, and although he's a dedicated greenie and all that sort of thing, he's now driving every day.
Just because it cuts down on his...
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe it. It just the transfers and the delays and who knows what problems every day it happens. I think people are just like, I'd rather be in charge of my own commuting destiny than ride Metro now.
Well, there's they've got a real selling job to do here. Yeah. And the new manager who shut down the system for a full day enraged a lot of people, but they found, I believe, 31 problematic
major problems.
And wiring could burst into flame at any time. And some people now are saying they're going to have frequent one-day shutdowns. And some people say they're going to have them on a regular basis until they get this problem fixed, and they may never get it fixed.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting when they announced that. Somebody brought this up to me. They were like, well, you know, they decided, okay, the Metro is so dangerous, we have to close it down tomorrow. But wait a minute, was it not as dangerous on the commute home?
Exactly.
Or, but I mean, but that's the issue, is that you have so many federal employees commuting from really far away. They would have all had to stay over in hotels or slept under their desks because they would have been stuck at the office.
Yeah. Well, I was, when you were talking about the hazards of getting to and from work.
Yeah.
Back in the day, it was not unusual to call federal workers in on a snow day and then send them home. And
During the day, they would
You literally, in some cases, it took you 2 hours to get to work. You were there for 10 minutes, and then they said go home. Well, what people don't understand, and it's grown more complicated by Metro and the fact that federal employment is up, is that Metro has... both buses and trains have a system where many of the personnel work split shifts. A lot of people don't think about that, but you work an AM shift, then you go home and eat, maybe take a nap, and you come back and work the PM shift.
That's so European, I feel.
Well, yeah, but the problem is when you release people early, then they oftentimes they can't get enough operators in to begin that early rush hour. And if they do, if they're successful in it, then it leaves people like us, you know, who don't get time off like that.
Yeah.
It leaves us walking out at 5 o'clock and there's nothing there because the shift is run.
Well, so, that's interesting.
And I know it was the Air Florida crash, which was before your time, but an airliner called Air Florida, DC to Florida, naturally.
Makes sense.
It was February, I believe, and it was terrible snow, icing.
Oh, is this the one that hit the bridge?
Right. Metro broke down. I was on a Metro trying to get there to cover it.
Yeah.
The plane hit the 14th Street Bridge. The tail of the plane hit the bridge, killed a number of people. But the irony, if you will, is that they had released government workers early.
Wow.
And so some of the people on that bridge would not have been there had they not been released early. Whoever was in charge at the time, they said, never again. We're never going to let them go early. And I think with some exceptions, they've that's what they've done. We're running out of time here, Meredith, and I appreciate you coming in. But could you recap again what the transit benefits are and what your story was all about?
Sure.
And that's transit benefits lost in translation, if you want to see it.
Yes. So transit benefits, what they do is cover federal employees who commute to work and they use mass transportation. If they want to apply, they can get these benefits to help cover their Metro cards or their tickets on a commuter train, not just in DC, but all over the country if you happen to have, or a commuter bus. And so this past year, Congress passed their omnibus spending bill, which included a bump up of benefits to $255 for 2016. Along with a $250 a per month benefit that should be paid retroactively from 2015. When you will get that, still to be determined.
Is there an if in that?
Yeah,
when and if
yeah.
also?
Ideally, yes, but how long that will take and if agencies will work to get that done, yes, that's all kind of up in, that's a big if. But for people who have never applied for this before, maybe it's your first federal job, you don't know, you can go to the Department of Transportation's webpage, and they have a big FAQ section on, can you apply for this? How do you apply? That kind of thing. And so far, it sounds like agencies have told their employees, hey, you can apply for these benefits, or if you already have them, you should be seeing an increase in your benefits. But exactly when they were told, employees said, range between early January to now. Some are still kind of confused on when these benefits kick in and when the retroactive ones will come in as well. So it's just a lot of gray area.
Well, it's interesting, as you say, too, some people, this is a big, big deal, not only financially,
yeah.
but the decision whether to drive as or ride.
Or to ride, yeah.
Others don't even know it exists.
Yep.
Others don't, and it's all over the place in government. This is probably question impossible, but is it possible that maybe some people in agencies will get the benefit, get the higher benefit, and or get it retroactively, and some won't?
That is a good question. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a possibility, and one agency might see it faster than another, but you would hope it would all come at once, but that's a pretty big hit.
Yeah. It was interesting to me. I was kind of shocked when I saw your story mm-hmm. because of the big jump, because the Congress, everything they're doing, particularly the Republicans in the House, to minimize federal pay raises. They're talking about eliminating the defined benefit retirement plan for future federal workers. So everything has been cut. And then if you increase by $55 a benefit that's already $200 a month, something like
yep.
that, if you increase that by $55 in theory for 1 million, 2 million people,
that's a lot of money.
I don't see the rationale.
Yeah.
Well, Meredith Summers, thank you so much for being with
us. You're
welcome. Okay, we'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Next up, we're going to be talking with Nicole Ogrusko. She's a staff writer for us and does many, many other things. And for her sins in this current life, she's been assigned to look at the budget process, specifically the House Republican budget. And it's not a fun read for federal workers, correct?
No. Specifically, we're seeing there's four major proposals in this GOP budget that might be familiar to federal employees that we've all seen before. And three out of the four of them directly would impact Fed's pay and benefits, specifically their retirement. So the first one that we're looking at is the potential reduction in the G fund interest rate is included in the GOP's budget. And this is something that we've heard about before. If you remember, Congress considered making this change to the G fund to pay for transportation updates in the highway fund. This was about last year, I believe. And at the time, the proposal was to calculate the G fund interest rate using a 3-month average instead of the current 4-year average. And that idea did die in Congress. At the time, the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board said that that change would pretty much make the G fund essentially worthless for TSP participants. And the budget committee, an interesting point about this proposal that they put out, there aren't too many details as to how much all of these proposals would actually save. So at the time, the budget committee said that this fund in the G fund interest rate would save $32 billion.
That's billion with a B. Right?
Billion with a B over 10 years.
So reversing that order then, if it's going to, quote, save that figure, and who knows if it will or not, then by the same token, it would cost federal workers and retirees who were invested in the G fund, they would get $32 billion less than they would under the normal procedure.
Right. I think they would see $32 billion less in potential earnings and savings and that sort of thing. So the Federal Retirement Investment Board, they administer the TSP, and they are not thrilled with this. That would be pretty obvious, yeah. I would think. And so they said that when the G Fund interest rate is reduced, this could actually have an impact on new military members who actually will be automatically enrolled into the TSP by 2018. This is a congressional mandate. There's supposed to be new members of the military will be enrolled in the TSP at that time. And so their argument will be is that this change in the G Fund interest rate would majorly impact new members to the military.
You know, that's a shame, because the idea of, I think, mandatory enrollment is good, because most people are not lifers in the military. They don't make a career and they don't retire from it. They're in 3, 4, 7 years, sometimes 10 years, but again, they don't retire. So they really need a 401k to help them in whatever they go on to in civilian life. And if they get one that's paying next to nothing, it hits them when they retire, and it will last throughout retirement, because one of the goals in retirement is to keep ahead of inflation. And at that rate, you're not going to do that.
Right. And if you're considering joining the military and you hear about this possible change and, you know, this possible change to your retirement benefits could essentially you might not be earning as much as you might otherwise, that might deter some people from maybe joining the military, or might give them some second thoughts. And I'm sure Congress wouldn't want to hear that.
Yeah, and certainly if you got in and figured it out, you might not want to stay as long as you had planned to do. And also the G Fund, that's also a Social Security matter as well, I believe.
Right. And it's the Federal Retirement Investment Board, they mentioned that the G Fund is actually the safest and one of the most popular funds for TSP participants. So this really would have a pretty big change.
Yeah. And when they use the term safe, they're talking about not losing any money. But most financial planners will tell you safe is keeping up with inflation. And if you're in the G Fund exclusively, you're probably, well, of course, you're a federal worker with another annuity, you may be all right. But if that's your primary source of income, it's not safe in that sense, you know.
Right. And another proposal that we're hearing about in the GOP budget, again, this shouldn't surprise anyone necessarily at all, but increasing federal employees' contributions, FERS employees, to their defined benefit plans. Again, there was no mention exactly what that increase might look like, how much savings could potentially be realized, or when this would possibly take place. Again, if you look at the proposals that have come up in the past, we can get an idea of what this might look like. But again, no specific mention in this particular proposal for fiscal 2017, what exactly those savings would be.
Reminds me of an old Army expression, do something even if it's wrong. You know, just let's do something for the sake of doing something. And it's a lame duck Congress. It's a lame duck presidential year. So you wouldn't expect much to come out of this. I guess the danger is, at the last minute, in a burst of energy, speed, peak, they could do something.
Right. And there are many questions about exactly what this proposal from the House Budget Committee, what exactly it all means. We've been told that the Senate will not prepare its own budget proposal, again, because those top line funding levels have already been set for 2017. So this is really an exercise on the House part. And it's unclear exactly where it'll go or what will happen when the House gets back from recess in a couple of weeks. It's pretty unclear what's going to happen with all of these proposals.
Right. And did you say there was another one, a third plan?
Yes. So another option is to end the special retirement supplement for FERS employees. So let's say you retire early at age 56. You would get the equivalent of your Social Security benefit until the age of 62, I believe, when you'd be eligible for Social Security. And so this proposal would end that. Essentially, it says that it would provide significant savings. Again, there was no mention of what those savings were and how much they would save over time. The House Budget Committee mentioned several times in its proposal that the idea of having more defined contribution retirement plans. They mentioned that this is much of what the private sector uses, and this would give the language that they use is this would give federal employees more flexibility and more freedom over how their retirement outlook is in the future. So that's another
more freedom, less money.
Maybe. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That I know that supplement, depending on when you retire, between the time you're and a variety of things, it can be thousands of dollars a year. So you could lose thousands of dollars for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And I think there's also the sticky question of people who by virtue of their jobs have to retire. Law enforcement, firefighters, air traffic controllers, that I think they're required to retire at in their 50s. So that would, you wonder if that would impact them as well.
I believe it would. I know there have been some provisions that would, there have been some provisions in Congress that have passed in the past that would prevent that sort of thing from happening. But again, it's kind of unclear exactly what the House Budget Committee is proposing with this and what exactly it would mean for everyone, just because there aren't many details, honestly.
Yeah. I guess they're intentionally vague, and they're just showing that they, again, want to do something. It reminds me of the inspector who, alongside Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca, and he says, round up the usual suspects. And that's what they're doing consistently with federal workers.
Right. And another usual suspect we'll mention is the House Budget Committee is also proposing, you know, cutting the actual size of the federal workforce. We've heard, how many times have we heard about this?
Yeah.
And they're proposing a 10% cut ultimately to the number of federal employees, mostly through attrition. So when one person leaves, just not hiring that person or hiring a replacement to replace the person who retires or leaves for whatever reason. So that's another possibility on the table, at least in the House budget proposal.
They do, regardless of which party it is, they do reinvent the wheel, because they've tried this again and again, and what happens is the wrong people retire. And if you can't replace them, if you literally can't replace them, then you get this very lopsided agency or government or operation, and then invariably it self-destructs and they drop it. But then every 4 years they reinvent it.
Right. I think a good example of that is right now, at least, is probably the IRS. I mean, I think we heard from the commissioner, John Koskinen, that they're not hiring. And probably more problematic is the fact that they have very few young federal employees that are coming to their agency. And so they've been losing people through attrition. But then at the same time, that's not really making anyone who's maybe younger want to come work for the IRS. And so ultimately, I'm kind of wondering how that will work out, especially as more people do retire, and what that would do for the agency. I think that might be a good example of what you're talking about.
Yeah. And Koskinen at the National Press Club, I think it was last week, but he's making light of himself, but he was very serious at the same time. And I think he said that, according to a recent poll, 14% of the American people preferred Vladimir Putin, the of the Soviet Union, over himself, you know,
right.
And laughing all the way. But yeah, that's a terrible position. It's IRS, you know, we can't do without it. Yet it's not a popular place for obvious reasons. And you get National Security Agency, the CIA, are always listed, or lately have always been listed, among the top potential employers for young college people, which is what the government wants and needs. The IRS is never up there.
Right. And I think it's also just sort of the dialogue about the IRS is never positive, especially when it involves you paying taxes. But I guess the younger generation maybe also doesn't have a sense of what the IRS does and how we can't necessarily function without it or an agency like it.
Yeah, it's incredible. Everybody agrees it's one of the, you can call it a collector, but it's one of the few money makers in the government. I think it brings in 90% of that, followed by the Minerals Management Agency, but people don't know that. We need to take a short break here and be right back on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Nicole Ogrusko. Nicole, switch gears if we could for a second here. You have become our resident expert on the VA, you poor soul. It's the largest non-defense agency. And I think anybody who's watched the news or read the news knows that it's been having problems. And the Congress, and correct me if I'm wrong, Congress has been insisting, and they're starting with VA, but they're probably going to go government-wide if they get this, make it easier to fire people,
right.
Make it easier to move executives around. And, of course, this is in response to that problem in Phoenix and I think one other VA hospital where they were cooking the books. Got caught, admitted it, and the Congress said, off with their heads. Where is that?
So there are so many different proposals out there. The VA specifically is working, has said that it's been working with Congress to come up with new accountability procedures specifically for the senior executives, the people that Congress has indicated that they don't want to stick around, particularly when you hear about some of these scandals in Phoenix and in other places. And what's interesting about this is, so their latest proposal essentially would allow medical professionals within the Veterans Administration to be reclassified under Title 38. The initial thought was that all senior executives or most senior executives would be classified under Title 38. They're currently under Title 5 now. And that would make many changes to how the agency hires senior executives and appraises them and pays them, and then also how they discipline them, which is the big buzzword right now is discipline and also accountability. So now what they're looking at is moving those medical professionals under Title 38. Their argument is that it will be easier to hire more medical professionals, doctors, nurses, medical center directors specifically, and they're having a real problem with that right now, and keep everyone else under Title V, but change some of the disciplinary process that gets involved with this. So they want to make it a little bit easier for the agency to discipline senior executives who are accused of misconduct. The thought there is that when they go before the Merit Systems Protection Board, they'd no longer go before administrative judges. They would go, the decisions would be decided by the board itself, the board members themselves. And then they also mentioned a few other procedures that they're mulling right now as to make this disciplinary process easier.
I think the last two secretaries of the VA said they didn't need any more power. They had enough to do the job and, in effect, kindly telling Congress to buzz off, but Congress did not.
Yeah, and what's interesting is going to some of these hearings where, particularly in the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, they've been, I hear over and over, give the secretary the authority to hire, fire, discipline, you know, appraise, pay, et cetera, all of these employees. And my thought is, does the secretary want all of that authority? Because that's a lot of decision-making power under one person. And as far as we could tell right now, the secretary seems to be okay with that, particularly in the Senate. It seems as if the department has been working very closely with the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, and it looks as if they're going to actually have a kind of a complete omnibus overhaul of the Veterans Choice Act and some other things, including this disciplinary process, in the next few weeks or so. So we should see something on this pretty soon.
You had a story on March 23rd. I'm looking at it here. Few options for VA to add harsher punishment for VBA executives. And the background was there were four top officials or high officials that were disciplined. Something happened. Took the cases to the Merit Systems Protection Board, and the board let them go?
Right. So there were four people potentially involved in, it was a relocation program scandal or a controversy. And two of those cases did go to the Merit Systems Protection Board. Two did not. And MSPB essentially overturned punishments for two of those executives. Their argument was that the VA did not punish those two executives consistently with the other two executives that were involved. And so when the VA heard that, they decided to reinvestigate the situation. And what we see here are new punishments for all four of those people who were potentially involved.
And I'm trying to recall now, it seems like two of the executives were transferred to other jobs that in locations of their choice. Well, I think one of them, it was her hometown, but where they were going to make more money.
Yes, they would make more money, but would have fewer responsibilities or fewer...
Kind of job we all want.
Right, yeah. Right. The dream scenario, yeah. I guess. Yes. So that was kind of at the crux of the issue here.
Yeah. Well, your sense, again, is it probably as good as anyone's, whether you've been doing it 1,000 years like I have or lesser time for you. Is any of this likely to happen this year?
I think major reform coming to the veterans.
You do?
Yes, okay. It will happen this year. The House has also been pretty vocal about wanting to get something done this year. The Senate indicated that it had a very fast timeline for getting its own version kind of out the door and for open for debate. I think the question is what exactly those changes will look like. And when they will happen, and you know, particularly I think for our audience, what those changes will be like for senior executives, and even how they could impact other senior executives at other agencies. If it can happen at the VA, maybe it could happen in other agencies.
Yeah, and you know, and going back to the budget that you mentioned earlier, it's been approved. The numbers are vague, but the intent is there, and there are a couple of sleepers in that, and one of them is this changing the interest rate on the G fund, which I think half of all investors have at least some money in a G fund, and a significant number have all of their money in the G fund, so they take away billions of dollars in future earnings and interest on that. And that's one that it's kind of hard to wrap your head around it or get excited about. Oh, they're going to mess with the G fund. And the other one is this Social Security supplement that a lot of people don't even know about until they qualify for it. And yet it could mean it could change your retirement plans. If you plan to leave at 57 for health reasons or whatever, and they said, fine, but you're not going to qualify for Social Security until you're 62, and you're not going to get this supplement that you would normally have gotten. I mean, that could be a game changer for some people, couldn't it?
I think so, yeah. You know, especially if, I think, like you mentioned, thousands of dollars that you would potentially get a year if you got that Social Security supplement. So, of course, this could impact federal employees' decisions about when they retire and if they can retire and if they're able to retire earlier mm-hmm. than age 62, if you know what decision they'll make there. So yeah, I think it could definitely have an impact, at least on the decisions that federal employees are making.
Well, keep us busy. Nicole, thank you for joining us here today on Your Turn. Thanks to Lauren Larson for producing the show. We'll see you next week. I hope you have a good week. Stay safe.